This is WABF, and it's time now for the Conservative Watchdog Show with Dr. Lou Campomenosi, former president of the Common Sense Campaign and adjunct professor of political science. This program is paid for by an anonymous donor. And good morning. Happy Friday, Dr. Lou.
Well, happy Friday right back to you, and good morning to you, Laurie.
Good morning.
It's good to hear you back on the show, and hopefully everything's working fine for you and everybody over there in Fairhope.
Yes, indeed.
We certainly do miss all of our friends over there. But so, you know, Laurie, it's one of these things with how we do this show and what I try to get out and talk about. And I know that the last 3 weeks I've started off with foreign policy. And, you know, some people say, well, why are you fixated on foreign policy? And the short answer to that is that foreign policy, you know, has so many implications for the national security that it seems to me that there is more than adequate justification for talking about foreign policy. I know domestic policy is obviously important, and we spend a lot of time, you know, dealing with that. I know that as a Common Sense Campaign, you know, our focus really was on local and state issues in the domestic sphere because we could impact that. But, you know, foreign policy issues and federal issues, whether they're domestic or foreign policy, are difficult for local people to have an influence on. And I think that, you know, the degree to which we can influence it, you know, certainly, you know, leads me to take advantage of the time I have on the air so that if anyone is listening, they can get some ideas about what at least my thinking is about it, and perhaps it will be their thinking too. So at any rate, I want to just sort of put that out there because, I, you know, as I said earlier when I called in, I do want to talk about Israel and Iran and this whole question of what's going on with these pro-Hamas anti-Semitic protests that's going on. And then if I have any time, which we'll see how much time I have left, and of course you always give me a few extra minutes, but I'm not going to count on that today, okay? I will just try to get through as much as I can. So I may be able to talk a little bit about Trump and this and what's going on with the immunity hearing at the Supreme Court. That's important. And possibly a few things about the Trump New York case that's ongoing. So let's get to the important foreign policy information that I want to try to cover today, okay?
Okay, Lou.
The question about Iran and Israel, you know, gets caught up in American foreign policy and what we're doing, okay? So let me set the stage, and I've been through this before over the years, and you know it, okay? Anything that we talk, anytime we talk about Iran, we have to talk about Obama and what Obama set in motion within the Democratic Party's foreign policy establishment, okay? And what that means essentially is that Obama wanted to reach out to the Iranians and come to grips with, you know, making nice with them. And this started really in 2008. He sent letters to the Ayatollah and basically said, look, we don't need to be enemies. He went on to say when he made his Cairo speech in early 2009, you know, criticizing American foreign policy, being too aggressive, okay? And then, of course, the real test for Obama came that summer when the Green Revolution began in Iran. And what did Obama do? Absolutely nothing. Okay? Had we had a real CIA, the Green Revolution would have been supported, just like we supported, you know, the Polish workers who really rose up in 1980. And the CIA did support that. Did all sorts of different things, nonviolent support. But my point is, it's Obama's foreign policy vision that we can reconcile with the Iranians. And I would argue, and I've said this to you all before, that that's exactly what Biden is doing. He's brought in the old team, that has the same outlook as Obama. And it's even worse in this particular case, but you just had one guy on that team who is now found out under investigation for passing documents to the Iranians. I mean, that's how sick these people are about all this. So, again, that's the American background that the Israelis are dealing with, okay? So here's where I take up the story then, okay? Any kind of a calculation that the Israelis have about what to do about Iran has to be able to, you know, take into account the absolute importance and the incredible success they had in their surprise attack on the Iranians in response to the Iranians' failed blitz that they tried to pull off on the Israelis. Again, as we've said before, okay, the Israelis were able to totally dominate the Iranian airspace. That is an incredible feat, and it's an absolutely critical piece of information when it comes to looking at what is in store in terms of a future foreign policy objective for the Israelis. Okay, so as you look at what I just said and listen to that and think about this, okay, what do you think might be a calculation for the Israelis as they look at what Biden has been doing, you know, in relationship to their own war against Hamas and the bigger picture of American foreign policy versus Iran? Okay? So here you have, on the one hand, an analysis of the correlation of forces between Israel and Iran, which is totally in favor of Israel. Okay? And at the same time, the Israelis have to see what Biden has been doing. And, I mean, let's be honest about this, okay? Biden has done nothing more than throw the Israelis under the bus, okay, following the Obama plan. And again, it's so unreasonable. It's really hard to understand how Obama and Biden can have this feeling that they can placate the Iranians, and yet he's doing it. So it's especially important, in my view, to contrast what Trump did so successfully in terms of dealing with the Iranians. Now, here again, we get to the point where, you know, it's one thing to say, well, Biden's following Obama, and that's bad. And say, okay, if it's bad, why is it bad? Well, it's a pretty easy answer. Because the Iranians are the head of the snake. The terror snake is driven by the Iranians' ability to do what? Fund terror through their proxies, the Houthis, Hezbollah, and of course Hamas. So when you're dealing with that sort of a situation, it seems to me pretty clear that, you know, Trump was absolutely right to stop Iran's ability to fund terrorism in the Middle East and in the world. And as we've talked about many times before, the fact that, you know, Trump brought Iran to its knees is a critical component in our current thinking. Because guess what? Where was all the terrorism when Trump had them on their backs as far as their economy was? I mean, he was able to cripple them, and that meant that they did not have the money to fund all of their terror proxies. Okay? So, what does that really look like in terms of the broad foreign policy outlook that we're all looking for? Okay? Here you have a situation where Iran can't do what it wants to do in terms of creating world terror, especially terror aimed at the Israelis. Okay? And then you have Trump creating the Abraham Accords, which did what? Created a tectonic shift in the relationship between the Arabs and the Israelis. Absolutely unheard of. And I want to just kind of throw this in here, okay? When I was teaching my War on Terror class, I used a book by John Lewis Gaddis, who is really one of the very best, you know, analysts of foreign policy, okay? In his book, Surprise Security and the American Experience, he argued that American security was really going to be kind of guaranteed to the creation of an empire of liberty. Now, you think about that for a second, okay? It doesn't mean that we had to forcefully create an empire of people who were all democracies, but the argument here is that the more people who are governed by small-d democracies, Democrats, then there's an opportunity for all of us to just have a peaceful world, okay? Trump accomplished that. I mean, the Abraham Accords are part and parcel of this Gaddis idea of an empire of liberty. And so what ends up happening, though, is that as soon as Biden comes to power, what does he do? Okay? While the correlation of forces, you know, between us and the Iranians was very much in our favor, and Israel's too, what ends up happening is Biden quickly undid Trump's policy on Iran, just as he did with the stupid border. I mean, this is what is so incredible and why it is so totally frustrating that we are where we are today. But obviously, the border is, as we've all said before, this was a deliberate attempt to fundamentally change America. So I'm not going to go over all that again. But we know that's the reality. And so what about this business with the Iranians? Well, I mean, here again, in short order, he allowed Iran to fund its terror programs, okay? And I think one of the key issues here is the amount of money that has been, you know, poured back into the Iranian, you know, funding machine, really starting with in August of 21, where an IMF, an International Monetary Fund loan, which we control and Biden could have said no to, was allowed to go to the Iranians for $3.4 billion. And therein starts a consistent pattern of funding, allowing the sanctions to not be enforced that Trump had put in place. And so within short order, you had something along the lines of $80 billion. And again, I know you've probably seen and heard some of these things on TV and all like that. But the reality is, and here's the connection for the Israelis that they have to kind of think through. On the one hand, Biden talks about having ironclad support for the Israelis after October 7th. What has happened to that ironclad support? I mean, I've talked about it for the last 3 weeks. There is no ironclad support, okay? So whether it's saying, you know, okay, not vetoing a UN resolution calling for a ceasefire, or, you know, going on TV with Blinken and other surrogates talking about how, you know, it's important that the IDF does not, you know, stop humanitarian aid, that there's too much, you know, civilian casualties. I mean, these kinds of signals that that Obama is, I mean, Obama, see, I've got Obama in mind, but it is Obama. I mean, he's controlling all this, so we all know that. So the point is, here's Biden doing all of this stuff, which essentially undermines the ironclad support. In other words, they're throwing the Israelis under the bus. So here's where the Israelis have a dilemma. Okay, so on the one hand, they've got Biden talking about ironclad support, but what the hell do they see? They see that there is no ironclad support, right? I mean, am I the only one that sees less than ironclad support? I don't think so. Okay, so when you have this kind of an issue, then it seems to me that the fact that we're even able to talk about less than ironclad support raises the question of, well, why is this happening? What happened to the ironclad support? And the short answer to that, again, is obvious, that you have this pro-Palestinian wing of the Democrat Party. And what are they demanding? They are demanding that Biden back off of the Israeli commitment to ironclad support for doing what? For destroying Hamas. Now, again, we can argue to the cows come home that, you know, Hamas needed to be destroyed. I've said this in my classes forever, that really Netanyahu should have done this a long time ago and just liberated the Palestinian people from the grip of the Hamas butchers. Okay? So, I mean, it finally took the October 7th, you know, attack for the Israelis to do what was necessary, at least what I've been advocating for a long time. Okay? And, of course, it doesn't matter what I'm advocating. Okay? I get that. But it's interesting that in all those years of me talking about that in my classes, it's finally come to the point where the reality of what Hamas was and is has finally seeped into the American understanding. Okay? I mean, this was a no-brainer from the get-go. And I know I've talked about this before on a show, so I'm not going to elaborate on it. But it was such a no-brainer that I don't know. I mean, it is what it is. So here we have a situation, though, that in Biden's offering this ironclad support post, you know, October 7th, what does that do to his own political base? Well, guess what? You've got Tlaib from Michigan and Omar from Minnesota, and what's the political fallout of all the support for Israel? Well, it's pretty clear. 100,000 people voted uncommitted in the Michigan Democrat primary. Why is that? Because they are opposed. Tlaib and them, all of these Muslims in Dearborn and all the rest of that, have been in opposition to the pro-Israeli policy that's ironclad, that was given by Biden. And so as Biden sees this political problem that he has to deal with, which I've talked about before, I'm not going to go into it too far, but the fact of the matter is that political problem is driving his policy, okay? And as long as that political threat is there, I mean, what do you think he's going to do? And you're seeing him do exactly what he needs to do, putting his electoral, you know, success in front of that ironclad support to our most important ally, I would argue, in the world, certainly in the Middle East, the only democracy in the Middle East. I mean, it's amazing how this turning on Israel, you know, starting in the UN, not vetoing that ceasefire issue, and then, of course, demanding that there's more, you know, humanitarian support, vocally on TV having his surrogates talk about issues pertaining to, you know, civilian casualties. Now, understand one thing here. Any accounting of civilian casualties that uses the public health system numbers coming out of Gaza are suspect, because they manipulate all that, number one. That's Hamas-controlled numbers. And the reality is, it's Hamas that has created the very danger that its own people are under, because they are embedded in the people. And then the fourth thing I would say about this is that there are different studies that have shown that the IDF has made unbelievably, careful, approaches to dealing with the civilian, problem as they're going in to destroy Hamas. Okay, so I think that, for Israel to think that it's going to be able to finish destroying Hamas is what they want, but that's not necessarily what Biden has to have to survive politically. So we really have this problem. And so this whole question of where politics comes into these actually existential problems for the Israelis is something that I think that, and this is my counsel to the Israelis, this is where they have got to take into account the correlation of forces that is now in their favor before the Iranians get the bomb. Now, that's another one of these issues. How close are they to the bomb? It depends on who you want to talk to, okay? So let's just assume for a second that they're not going to get it in 6 weeks or 2 months or maybe even 6 months, okay? Let's just assume that. So you've got a window of opportunity that the Israelis have. And so here's where my thinking is, okay? Israel cannot count on a Biden-led administration, given the situation I've described that Biden has in trying to placate his crazy pro Hamas Nazi base, okay? That's a given. And so what should the calculation be on the Israeli part, okay? My feeling is that given what they were able to do 2 weeks ago, total domination of the Iranian airspace, okay, they need to go ahead and preemptively attack the Iranians now. And you say, oh my God, it's Dr. Strangelove on the air. Yeah, maybe so. But you know what? If never again means anything, and it does, and I think Netanyahu certainly is committed to that, if never again means anything, and you're dealing with a fickle America that's willing to throw Israel under the bus because it's in Joe Biden's political interests, then what do you want the Israelis to do? Wait for the inevitable guillotine to hit them? I mean, that's what's coming. When you really think about it, that's what the Iranians will do if they ever could get a bomb, and if they had a missile that could actually hit the Israelis with any kind of a bomb. That would wipe out Israel. And that's what they want. Death to America, death to Israel. So you don't think if they get a long-range missile with a bomb on it, it's not going to hit somewhere in the United States? I mean, hey, they're going to go to Allah and all be martyrs, and it's all wonderful. 70 virgins. So, I mean, if that's their thinking, which for 45 years that's been their thinking, death to America, death to Israel. Well, My feeling is that the Israelis have every right to preempt the forthcoming problem that the Israelis will have if the Iranians are allowed to get the bomb. So I would say a preemptive attack is fully justified, and that I would start it as quickly as possible with the goal of eliminating the nuke program. And as long as you've got air superiority or air total air control, then they can do that in several ways. They can bomb the hell out of it, or they can put their troops on the ground and go in there and just destroy all of it. They can certainly take out the oil industry. I'd definitely do that. And then the last thing I would do is make sure that the IRGC is attacked in as many places as possible to take that force out, so that the civilians who have been fighting against the Ayatollah regime can finally rise up and eliminate the regime itself, an internal, you know, coup. And here again, if we had a real CIA that could do something, and that was Bill Buckley's argument, if we had a real CIA, we might not need to do a whole lot of other things in the world. But be that as it may, you have this situation that in my view, you know, is the only guarantee that Israel will have a chance to avoid what is forthcoming if the Iranians get the bomb. And if we, I mean, I wish that Trump was in power now, because if Trump was in power, he would have done exactly what I'm talking about doing: preemptively eliminate the snake. The head of the snake has got to go, and the only way we can really, I see our way clear to doing that, I mean, because Biden's not going to do it, is to have the Israelis take it and run with it. So, I don't know. It just seems to me that this is something that has to be done, and it should be done. So we'll see what happens there. Okay, so let me shift to what's going on with all of these protests that are popping up on all of these college campuses, especially the elite college campuses. I mean, it's an interesting, you know, phenomenon to see these smart kids who are supposedly smart being unable to answer questions like, river to the sea? What river are you talking about? And, no answer on either sea or river. So what exactly is this all about? Well, it is all about the degree to which the educational institutions have become anti-Semitic in their own right, linked to their pro-revolutionary social justice approaches to education. So it's no wonder that you've got ignorant students, you know, mouthing all sorts of, you know, BS, you know, statements like from the river to the sea, without having an understanding of what any of that means. I mean, the Jews have been in this particular geographic location for over 2,000 years, okay? And the Jewish diaspora, which took place under the Romans, starting in about 30 BC, did not leave all Jews out of Palestine. Alan Dershowitz wrote about this. Professor Dershowitz is just really super in his analysis of various things. But, you know, he's pointed out that there were pockets of Israeli Jews there even after the diaspora. So you have a situation where now you have these students mouthing all these things about Palestine being for the Palestinians. Well, I mean, the Jews have as much right, if not more right, to this landmass than anyone else, because they've been there the longest, even though they were forced out. But when they came back in 1947 and 1948, it was clear, and this is an interesting point, you know who occupied Gaza after the 1947 war? It was Egypt. The Egyptians had no concern for so-called Palestinians. The so-called Palestinians were in Jordan. So, I mean, it's a mixed bag as far as all of this, who owns Palestine and who owns Gaza. But once the Israelis left Gaza in 2005, Ariel Sharon pulled them out, turned it over, under the heading of land for peace. That's what the Israelis bought into, okay? And over the years since then, what has happened to land for peace? Well, all they got was Hamas in return with, again, part of the head of the snake giving them the money for terrorism and all the rest of it. So how can you have land for peace theories when you've got people who are trying to destroy you? So whether it's Hamas in Gaza, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and later the Houthis in Yemen, you're still fighting the same problem. And so from a theoretical standpoint, land for peace has no meaning when you've got people who all they want to do is kill you. And I think that here again we get back to this whole question of how are these pro-Hamas people, you know, able to do all of this? Well, in part, they're being funded by all sorts of different groups, okay? And of course, you know, the usual suspects you get with Soros, the Tides Foundation, another left-wing social justice group. You've got big Democrat donors who are on the left who are supporting them. You even have some left-wing Jewish groups like Voice for Peace and If Not Now, supporting what's going on. Then you've got these, you know, corporate donors coming out of Vanguard and Fidelity funds following the line, okay? So as we get into all of this, you need to take a look at, you know, the BDS movement. Well, BDS has been around for about 10 years. That's boycott, divest, and sanction. Well, what does that mean? Well, these people want to boycott Israel. They want to make sure that they are that American, you know, are divesting from Israel in terms of whatever, and then sanctioning. Well, I mean, look at what Biden is doing in terms of already doing the sanctioning part of all this. And I think that it's important to understand that when, you know, Jews in Judea are being sanctioned, as well as a group from the IDF, these kinds of sanctions are well within what the BDS movement has done. So the BDS movement is nothing new, but the manifestation of all of this, you know, because of the war against Hamas, that's exactly what's going on, and the degree to which it's being allowed to move on is another one of these questions about, well, the rise of anti-Semitism, as Netanyahu said, this is so similar to what happened to the Jews in Germany in the 1930s. Now, I would argue that there is a comparison that's valid in a way, but the systemic and brutal approach to the Jews in Germany, I don't think is replicated here, but you have to keep in mind that when you look at FBI statistics in terms of hate groups, I mean hate crimes, what group is the biggest target? 51% of hate crimes are committed against the Jews. Now, the Anti-Defamation League has a higher percentage. Okay, we can argue about that. But the point of this is, this incipient anti-Semitism is here in the United States. And it's being full-blown, you know, for everyone to see in the manifestations of the attacks on Jewish students, the fear that's there and going to class. Those kinds of things are part and parcel of something that we need to step up to the plate and say no to. Fortunately, in the Deep South, you know, this is not happening yet. But I would urge everyone to write and make your voices known that this cannot continue to go on. We have got to nip it in the bud. And, you know, when Eisenhower sent troops to Little Rock in 1957 because the black kids who were trying to integrate the Little Rock schools, you know, were under attack, he sent not the National Guard, but the 101st Airborne, okay? And if that's what it takes to protect Jewish students at these so-called elite universities, then it seems to me we need to do that. But will Biden do that? Well, of course not. He can't dare do anything like that. Just like he can't dare to give an ironclad support to Israel, he can't dare interfere with what's going on with all these encampments on these private property in, you know, in Colombia and other places. I mean, Colombia has caved in on this. Supposedly there's another deadline by noon today to see if the encampments are going to go away. Well, they're not going to go away because these phony baloney presidents are too afraid to do anything about it. It's just like the issues that we saw a few months ago when Harvard, MIT, and Pennsylvania, they were showing up at Congress giving testimony, and the next thing you know, they couldn't say that there were, you know, rules against anti-Semitic behavior in their handbooks. You've got to be kidding me. Two of them resigned. This president of Colombia, she needs to resign. I mean, you've got Jewish donors who are saying no more in all of these schools. They're slow to get the picture. But my argument here basically is that, you know, Biden cannot do anything about it because if he does, he's going to alienate the insane base that he's dealing with. So my feeling at this point is that we have got to get our voices heard, and I would urge you to write to your congressmen and your senators and let them know that this is not something that's in the American political tradition. We've got to stop it. So, Laurie, I see that I am now over time. So,
yes, you are.
Yes, I am. So let's wrap it up, and I'll talk more about some of this stuff on the issues of Trump and his the trial business next week, okay?
That sounds good.
All right. Thank you, Laurie. Thank you all. Have a great weekend. Talk to you next week, God willing.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Dr. Lou. You've been listening to the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campobonosi, former president of the Common Sense Campaign and adjunct professor of political science. This program is paid for by an anonymous donor. The opinions and views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or management. We will post the program in case you missed part of it at WABF1480.com. Now resuming regular programming.